Astonishing Legends Network.
Welcome back, everybody. I hope your summer is going great, but let's be serious. This is the last day of July, which means we are deep into the countdown to Halloween. But before Halloween, to get you ready for Halloween, I'm excited to announce Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf Live Tour, the Light in the Dark Tour 2026. Okay, grab your pencils and your small spiral-bound drugstore notebooks. Grab your shale and soapstone pencils and your seance slates. Your glass and alphabet. Get your Panasonic DR60 tape recorders out and make note of the following information. Our tour will debut in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, on Sunday, September 13th at 7 p.m. at the legendary Storm Crow Manor in Toronto. And special thanks to Suzanne Kay and Jennifer P. for helping us out for months to get this all set up. And thanks also to Trish D., who is always such a great fan of the show, and for her constant support and suggestions. Once again, we're going to be at Storm Crow Manor on Sunday, September 13th. Now, if you don't know Storm Crow Manor, you should. It is the coolest spot in Toronto. It's Toronto's geekiest bar. It's a three-story haunted Victorian mansion that, according to their website, conceals a sanity-shattering array of theme rooms, secret doors, catacombs, luminous bubbling cocktails, randomly generated burgers, and, oh yeah, tentacles. Behind the bookcase, a secret submarine chamber. Up the stairs, a mad scientist laboratory bar. Down the hall, a cyberpunk lounge bathed in neon and holograms. This is my kind of place. This place is very RHPB coded. It's got books and cocktails. Come on. And yes, they have amazing theme cocktails, plus all the normal ones, plus a full menu of food, from snacks to entire entrees, all of which look delicious. So come hungry and ready to join us for dinner. My show's going to be in the Red Rum, the Red Rum Room at 7 p.m., but you're going to want to get there early to explore the whole place and grab a drink with me and Susan before the show. That's Storm Crow Manor in Toronto on Sunday night, September 13th at 7 p.m. for Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf Live. Check out this place on the internet. You're going to love it. Now, you can get tickets now on Eventbrite. So go to Eventbrite and search for Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. It'll take you straight to our page. And keep checking back, because we're adding dates and locations every day. And they'll all be there on Eventbrite soon. So check Eventbrite and check your socials. More cities and locations coming soon. All right, time for the show. Here we go. The Paranormal Ranger by Stanley Milford Jr. In my career as a television writer, I have pitched, developed, or worked on no fewer than 11 shows about official law enforcement agencies investigating supernatural crimes. One was a comic book designed as a possible vehicle for Rosario Dawson called Occult Crimes Task Force. One of them was a show I co-created for ABC called The Gates. One of them ran for 6 seasons on NBC. It was called Grimm. And all of them followed in the footsteps of the most famous and successful TV show of this kind ever made, The X-Files. All of these shows were tricky to make work because you have to grapple with three conceptual challenges. First, you have to demonstrate upfront that a supernatural world actually exists. Second, you need a hero who, like the audience, is unaware of this world until the pilot episode introduces them and us to it. And third, you have to make clear to the viewer exactly how much the rest of the world knows about this supernatural world. A lot? A little? Nothing? Usually it's nothing. Now, this last one is really important because here's the thing. Not everyone believes in monsters and ghosts. In fact, a lot of people don't believe in anything supernatural at all. Traditionally, the journey of the main character is one of disbelief to belief. They must cross the border from one world into the other. I can't tell you the number of hours I have spent over the last 25 years grappling with the issue of how do we make the audience believe in a world where our hero confronts ghosts, Bigfoots, witches, and aliens. It would have been great if I'd known that for those same 25 years, Stanley Milford Jr. was actually doing it. In The Paranormal Ranger by Stanley Milford Jr., William Morrow, 2024, we learned that Stanley worked as a Navajo ranger for over 20 years, and for about half that time, he was assigned to investigate cases that were reported as paranormal. In his jurisdiction, the roughly 27,000 square miles that makes up the Navajo Nation, his official role as paranormal ranger was to, quote, listen to people, take their concerns seriously, and investigate their cases just as carefully as any other. Sounds like Fox Mulder to me. Now, if I was writing Stanley's life as a TV show, I'd probably start him out as a total skeptic. Have him grow up in New York City, barely aware of his Native American heritage. He joined the NYPD, a place where the only monsters are human. That'll be in the commercial. Then something calls him back to the Southwest, where he discovers a world where not all the monsters are human. That's also going to be from the commercial. Now, of course, that's not what happened to Stanley in real life. He didn't grow up in New York. He grew up in Oklahoma with his mother half of the time, and the other half of the time in the Navajo Nation near Fort Defiance, Arizona, with his father. He describes his childhood, however, as being one with, quote, a foot in each world, and this background allowed him to investigate supernatural cases with, quote, a balance of scientific objectivity and cultural insight. Stanley's journey takes place over decades, and in that time he learns that the stories of his childhood are more than just stories. Encounters with spirits, witches, aliens, and Bigfoot are things that really happen, and one by one, most of them happen to him. My friend and fellow TV writer Javier Grigio-Marxwatch coined the phrase operational theme. Now, this is a writing term, a little bit of insider TV writing jargon. It refers to something within the main character that harmonizes with the concept of the show. For instance, in The X-Files, we all know that Fox Mulder investigates supernatural crimes, but what makes the show emotionally compelling is that he too is the victim of a supernatural crime. His sister was abducted by aliens and never returned. So he totally gets it when he meets people who are in the middle of their own supernatural nightmare. He is uniquely situated, better than anyone else, to solve it, but even better, to understand how they feel. Local law enforcement may roll their eyes at these people, but Mulder never does. He knows what they're going through. Like Fox Mulder, Stanley Milford had an experience when he was young that changed him and made him realize that telling a crazy story doesn't mean you're crazy. It just means you've seen a little more of what the universe has to offer than most people do. Stanley's experience happened in the summer of 1986. He was 20 and living in Arizona. He had just seen Maximum Overdrive, the only movie ever written and directed by Stephen King, and a true testament to the power of cocaine. It was just after midnight, and he was leaving the theater when he saw an elderly man sitting alone on a bench. The old man asked Stanley for a lift to Fort Defiance, and because it was on his way, and Stanley is a very nice guy, he said sure. Everything about the ride through the dark desert night seemed normal, up until when the old man asked to be let out on the side of the highway in the middle of nowhere. But again, being a good guy and not wanting to question an older person, Stanley let him out and continued down the road. But just a minute later, he sensed something moving alongside his car. He glanced over and saw something huge running on all fours just outside the passenger window. It was keeping pace with him, and he was driving 60 miles an hour. He hit the gas, but the thing, whatever it was, sped up right along with him. From the book, quote, "I looked away from the road to try to get a better look at it and immediately wished I hadn't. This thing had a mouthful of long, jagged, gleaming white teeth. It turned its head and looked straight at me. Its eyes were fiery yellow and orange, like hot burning coals glowing in the darkness. Its lips were stretched backward in a sort of sinister grin. It looked straight into my eyes like it was seeing right through me into my soul. Its gaze was intelligent, hypnotic, and evil, and the message was clear. I could grab you, rip you to pieces, and eat you alive if I chose, and there would be nothing you could do about it. I knew in that moment that this thing was pure evil. The next thing I remember is sliding into the gravel driveway outside my dad's house. I told him my experience. He nodded sagely and said the words I already knew in my heart. Son, you just saw a skinwalker." Stanley's worldview got ripped open that night. All the stories he had been told his whole life about Bigfoot and ghosts and UFOs, and yes, skinwalkers, suddenly took on a whole new meaning. These weren't just stories anymore. These things were real. He felt scared and confused. And he also felt deeply grateful that his father didn't mock him or shrug off what he was saying. He had just entered a club. The club of people who have experienced deeply fucked up things. And whether he liked it or not, and he didn't, there was no going back. From then on, whenever someone told him a story about the strange, unbelievable, impossible thing that they experienced, he would say to himself, "My story's real. What if theirs is too?" In the fall of 1979, I was 13 years old. I was in the 8th grade, and I had my routine down pat. I'd get home from school by 3. I'd take a roll of Pillsbury canned biscuits, crack it open against the counter, and lay out the 12 disc-shaped dough blobs on a cookie sheet. Then I'd top each one with pizza sauce and shredded cheese and cook them in the oven for about 15 minutes so they'd be ready at 3:30 when the Rockford Files came on. These episodes were syndicated reruns in the afternoons, but I discovered the show in primetime over the summer. It was one of the shows I'd watch on Friday nights that would help me stay up until 11:30 when reruns of Kolchak the Night Stalker aired on something that called itself the CBS Late Movie. It was hard for me to stay awake until 11:30, but for Kolchak, I'd do it. I'd force myself. It was a way to prove my devotion. Because even though I was 13 years old and feeling very grown up, it was really scary to watch the Night Stalker alone, late at night, in a dark, quiet house where everyone else was already asleep. But being scared felt good in a way, too. I was starting to become interested in fear, in what it provoked, and how I reacted to it. Staying up late to watch the Night Stalker was compelling to me because, even though it scared me, I was in control of the experience. I was scaring myself, challenging myself to be brave, practicing in private, testing my limits, and trying to get stronger. It's probably no coincidence that another one of the things I did to stay awake until 11:30 was push-ups. That would make me stronger, too. I wanted to improve myself. I was in a hurry to become whoever it was that I was going to be. It was time to start getting my body and soul ready for whatever was next. It was time to become a man. But back to my mini pizzas. I would cook this snack for myself every day, and then I'd eat it while watching the Rockford Files. This was by far the best part of my day. The Rockford Files made me feel brave too, but in a different way from the Night Stalker. Rockford felt more real. In fact, to me, it felt like a documentary about being an adult in Los Angeles. I too would most likely live in a trailer by the beach and solve crimes. I loved Jim Rockford. I loved him because he was smart, but also funny. and instinctually brave when he had to be. But he didn't lead with that. He didn't think of himself as brave. In fact, quite the opposite. Jim Rockford tried to avoid trouble and conflict whenever he could. But when it happened, he could handle it. Every day I woke up desperately hoping to avoid trouble too. But it was because I felt like I couldn't handle it. Maybe by watching the Rockford Files, really watching it, studying it, I could learn to be like Jim Rockford. Every day I would ask myself, what would Jim Rockford do? And maybe somehow, by doing this, I could learn to be truly brave. I started keeping something I called a Rockford Files file. I used an official Brightwood Elementary School spiral notebook, and every day when Rockford came on, I would write down the name of the episode, the guest cast, the director, and the writer. Ladies and gentlemen, I have absolutely no idea why I started doing this, but it seemed absolutely essential and incredibly important, like a ritual, like doing push-ups to stay awake for the Night Stalker. In the year of our Lord 1979, the time I spent alone in front of the television became what I thought of as my church, my religion, my spiritual study, my real life. I wasn't zoning out. I was plugging in. For me, watching television was incredibly active. I was figuring out how to be a person in the world, the person I wanted to be. During the day at school, I was not the person I wanted to be. I was invisible, and I had finally accepted that. I had spent a lot of years at Brightwood trying to stand out and be remarkable or popular, trying to be seen, but it just hadn't worked out. For a while, when Kim Cortez was my girlfriend back in seventh grade, I felt like I finally was seen. But then she kissed Kenny Voltava, and I realized that I wasn't special. I was non-essential. Now I was in the eighth grade, and for some reason that year, there was a new district-wide PE curriculum which separated the boys from the girls, at least for a while. The boys would spend the next 6 weeks playing touch football under the hot sun on cracked asphalt. I have no idea where the girls went. Our coach was my homeroom teacher, Mr. Doty, who seemed even less interested in football than I was, but it didn't matter. He divided the boys into four random groups and then pitted us against each other. Sean Delgado, by far the most popular kid in our grade, was quarterback of the team I was placed into, and when it became clear I had no idea what football was or how to play, he told me I was to be a rusher. I assumed it was an inconsequential position, and I wasn't wrong. I lined up with the other rushers. One of them, Terry, a kid with an eye patch and a back brace, explained to me that the goal of the rusher was to run up and tag the quarterback of the opposing team before he threw the football. But there would be a defensive line protecting the quarterback, blocking these efforts. Fine. Whatever. Someone started shouting, then suddenly everyone was in motion. Rushers and blockers were slamming into each other like rams on a rocky mountaintop. By the way, does that sentence alone prove why I was terrible at sports? Suddenly, Neil Shambaugh, the other team's quarterback, moved right in front of me, his arm up, ready to throw. And I just ran up and tagged him. He looked at me, stunned, like I was literally invisible and had just appeared out of nowhere. Then suddenly my teammates were running at me. I assumed they were going to beat the shit out of me because I'd done something wrong. But they all seemed happy, like really happy. They slapped me on the back, but in a friendly way. I'd seen things like this happen on TV, but I had no idea what it felt like in real life. It felt pretty good. Maybe being a rusher isn't so bad, I thought. Before PE ended that day, I tagged the quarterback four more times. Our team won the game, and that's not a sentence I've ever written before. The other guys were talking about me enthusiastically, but for a reason I never could have anticipated. Sean Delgado came up to me and punched me hard on my left bicep and said with mock anger, "Why didn't you tell us you were good at something?" It hurt, but at the same time it felt good. I knew he was joking, so I laughed. And seeing him slowly smile made me feel like I was suddenly in the middle of a totally new thing in my life, a male bonding ritual. I went home that day a halfway hero. That afternoon, I sat in my rocking chair and ate my mini pizzas and watched the Rockford Files. But I had trouble following the plot. My mind kept drifting back to school and rushing and getting punched by Sean Delgado. It was starting to bruise and hurt when I touched it, but I kept touching it anyway. Even more than making out with Kim Cortez, I was finally feeling what it felt like to become a man. Stanley Milford became a Navajo Ranger in the year 2000. But it was in 2002 when he and his partner and best friend, John Dover, were assigned to be the first ever paranormal rangers. Here's what happened. There'd been a complaint against the department by an elderly woman from the Chuska Mountains who had reported that she had seen a Bigfoot-like creature step into her sheep corral and walk off with one of her sheep. But the responding officers hadn't taken her seriously. Chief Butler, head of the Navajo Rangers, called a meeting, and he wasn't happy. His reputation was stern and no nonsense. So no one dared laugh when he announced that from now on, reports like this were going to be, quote, investigated properly. And then he pointed at Stanley and his partner John and said, "You two guys are going to oversee these cases." What's fascinating is that Stanley instantly agreed. He somehow knew that he was uniquely suited to investigate these cases, not because of any belief he had in the paranormal necessarily, but rather because of the part of himself that was raised outside the Navajo culture. You see, many of his peers mocked the idea of the supernatural on the surface, but inside held to a deep and unshakable taboo that was instilled in them since childhood. In fact, it won't be hard to understand that it was these taboos that produced the mocking. Anything to hold the devil at arm's length. They believed that the best way to avoid trouble with the supernatural was to avoid any talk or acknowledgement of the supernatural at all. But Stanley didn't have these deep-seated biases. On the one hand, he suspected that paranormal events were possible based on his own lived experience. But he didn't fear that his mortal soul was endangered simply by engaging with the idea that such things might exist. Plus, Stanley had another reason to welcome this new assignment. From the book, quote, "I loved the 1970s TV show Kolchak the Night Stalker, which was about a reporter who investigated crimes with supernatural causes. This assignment felt like getting to step into Kolchak's shoes. Well, my God, who wouldn't love that? I knew there was a reason I loved this guy." Anyway, Stanley and John drove up into the Chuska Mountains to interview the old woman who had seen Bigfoot. They searched her property, but it had been a couple of weeks since the initial complaint, and there was no physical evidence of any kind. But the next night, Stanley returned to let the woman know he would be on her property throughout the night conducting surveillance to see if there was anything more he could find. Who knows? Maybe Bigfoot would come back. So, Stanley spends the night in his patrol car overlooking the property. He conducts foot patrols every hour, going deeper and deeper into the woods, and freaks himself out pretty good thinking about a movie he saw as a child called The Legend of Boggy Creek, which, if you haven't seen it, you should. Nothing turns up that night, but for Stanley, it was not wasted time. Quote, "One thing that did come from the Chuska Mountain Bigfoot case was that it set the tone for many other paranormal cases to come. I learned to listen to my gut instincts, my sixth sense. The outcome of this case helped me realize that unlike typical law enforcement cases, many times there would be no recovery of lost property or even clear evidence of a violation or infringement. I mean, it wasn't like we could put Bigfoot in handcuffs and read him his Miranda rights. Although that would be awesome." He continues, quote, "In many cases, the important thing was going to boil down to the manner of communication of the officers and the act of a timely response to the scene that showed the victim in a very clear and overt way that the Navajo Rangers did care about the people we served." Stanley later says he was glad they didn't find anything. After all, the assignment was brand new. The Paranormal Rangers had only existed for a few days. He wondered how he would react if he ever did come face to face with the supernatural. He wouldn't have to wonder long. By the next football game, they were on to me. I was still a rusher, but now I had a man assigned to me, Billy Shin, who I'd known since second grade. He'd shot up over the past year and now stood 4 inches taller than me and outweighed me by at least 15 pounds. I managed to slither past him a couple of times, but I didn't tag the quarterback even once, and we lost the game. I assumed everyone would blame me, but for some reason, they didn't. No one seemed to care about me specifically, one way or the other. I slowly began to understand this feeling as being on a team. I'd been on teams before, of course, but the difference now was that I was trying. I was invested in winning, not just for myself, but on behalf of something larger. And the fact was, actually playing football was becoming beside the point anyway, because now I was inside a group from which I had always been excluded. The sports guys. Sean Delgado, John DeGeorge, Billy Shin, Neil Shambaugh, Kenny Voltava, Eddie and Adrian Rojas, and a new kid, a giant blonde Swedish guy named Scott Svensson. Scott was valued for his size and ferocity and little else. He was what we'd now call bipolar, either screaming with laughter or screaming with rage, and almost no middle ground in between. In a weird way, his presence secured my place within the group. He was the one even Sean held at arm's distance. Scott made people uncomfortable. He was tolerated, but mostly you just hoped he'd go away. I had almost every class with Sean Delgado, so we drifted from room to room and sat together, and the day became one long hangout. I had always been the funny one, but now Sean seemed to not only respect my sense of humor, but revealed one of his own. The word indubitably became our constant punchline, always spoken with reverence and with one index finger held in the air. If one of us answered a question in Mr. Doty's class, the other would raise their hand, get called on, and simply say with the utmost seriousness, "Indubitably." This was roundly acknowledged by all eighth graders as the funniest thing in the world. And the fact that it was Sean Delgado and I doing this, people caught on fast that we were friends, or more to the point that he was allowing me to be his friend, and this unlikely partnership did not go unnoticed. Mr. Doty would see us walking into class and announce, "Well, here comes Fonzie and Richie." We hated it, but he wasn't far off. Sean was the cool, dangerous one, and I was the innocent, nice guy. But somehow, it worked. There was mutual respect between us, which was frustrating because Sean didn't always feel like showing it. I mean, we could joke around, but if I crossed an invisible line and took the joking too far, Sean's smile would disappear, and he'd punch my left bicep hard, always in the same spot, the knuckle of his middle finger poking out to cause maximum pain. You weren't allowed to block the punch or duck it. My only defense was to shift my arm slightly so the punch didn't always land in the exact same spot. I had a permanent spreading bruise on my left arm. Once I tried to punch his arm in return, but as I was rearing back, he just stood there unmoving and said, "Don't start something you can't finish." His threat was so genuine, it scared me. And once I was scared, he'd grin and hoot and make my fear the new focus of all the jokes. But in the middle of it all, I was never ignored and I was never told to leave. So I remained on the inside, and the inside was where I wanted to be. Anything was better than the outside. In 2009, Stanley Milford and John Dover were called to the home of an elderly Navajo man who lived on a remote farm in Ganado, Arizona. He had seen a UFO hovering over his property and even witnessed the inhabitants wandering through his yard. Stanley points out that, according to their culture, Navajos overwhelmingly believe that the aliens who come to Earth do so to benefit humans and, quote, influence us to do good things to avert war and conflict. But that doesn't mean the Navajo people are happy to see them. And there is something exceptionally eerie, almost sinister, about this particular account. From the book, according to the old man, the craft flew slowly and deliberately around his home before moving a quarter mile of away and hovering above the tree line. Then the old man saw lights at ground level below the craft. They gradually began making their way toward his home. His dog ran out toward the lights and disappeared into the dark. A few moments later, the dog yelped in pain as if kicked. The old man retreated inside his house and locked all the doors and windows. But when he looked outside, he could see the bobbing lights getting closer and closer. As they entered his yard, he saw that the lights were being held by four beings. Quote, they were about 3 feet tall, childlike in their proportions, with gray skin. Their heads were oversized, about the diameter of a basketball, and they either had large black eyes or were wearing goggles. The old man couldn't tell if the beings were naked or simply wearing tight-fitting suits. The lights they held weren't like flashlights. They emitted a solid beam of light about 1 inch in diameter, and each of the four creatures' lights were a different color: red, blue, green, and yellow. As they made their way around the side of his house, the old man gathered his courage, went outside, and followed them. But it was dark, and he fell. And by the time he was able to stand again, the creatures had retreated to their craft, which he then watched disappear high into the night sky. The sighting occurred on a Saturday night, and Stanley and John were investigating within 48 hours. While the UFO and the aliens were gone, they did find some rather strange physical evidence. Circular tracks that led from the woods where the UFO was seen all the way to the old man's home, in exactly the path the lights had traveled. Stanley and John simply could not come up with a natural explanation for what could have made the strange circular tracks. This was not the first UFO encounter that Stanley and John investigated. In the years since the Paranormal Rangers had gone into business, there had been dozens, as well as more reports of Bigfoot sightings and even skinwalkers. By this time, Stanley was beginning to develop a theory, which will be familiar to all of you if you've ever read anything by John Keel or listened to more than 2 episodes of Astonishing Legends. Quote, we were beginning to get a sense that many of our paranormal cases might be linked. Perhaps, I thought, UFOs are interdimensional crafts. Rather than traveling through space, these beings are using dimensions as a means of getting from one place to another. This might also account for the sudden appearance and disappearance of creatures like Bigfoot. Yup, everything is connected. And like John Keel, Stanley was about to become the focus of the phenomenon he was observing. A few weeks later, the rumors started. And it spread across the 8th grade fast. A bunch of guys at Highlands, our rival elementary school, had been talking shit about us. There was going to be a fight Friday after school at Sequoia Park, and Sean Delgado made it clear I was expected to be there. This was all news to me. I was unaware that we were rivals with Highlands, especially considering that our schools had no official contact of any kind. I was unaware that they'd been talking shit about us. It was unclear why they would or how any of us would even know if they did. But a fight? That wasn't unthinkable. There had already been what the district was calling mob fights. Groups of 12 to 20 kids all suddenly going at it. It had happened in the last month at both Repetto Elementary and Inez. Now, it had apparently evolved into a new thing, a school-against-school fight, the next logical step. Either way, it didn't matter. I was in. Of course, I didn't really have a choice. and I was terrified. But if Sean and John DeGeorge and the Rojas twins and Kenny and Billy and Neil and probably a bunch of other guys from Brightwood were going to be there, then I had to be there too. After all, what would Jim Rockford do? He'd back up his friends, that's what. It felt like football again, only way worse because people were going to be attacking each other in unsupervised rage. This was going to be a problem for me, because although I had rage, it was completely supervised and inaccessible to me. But my new friends seemed to have rage bubbling below the surface at all times, just waiting for a chance to boil over. I thought about Scott Svensson. That guy was no joke. He scared people. He was like an unexploded bomb. He might kill a guy. Did Highlands have a guy like Scott? Did they have a bunch of them? Were they all like Scott? I watched the Rockford Files extra close that week, looking for pointers. In one episode, Jim casually lit a cigarette, then flicked it into a guy's face and sucker punched him. It was so cool. I thought this move could work for me, but I didn't have ready access to any cigarettes. Maybe at the fight I could flick something else into someone's face. I looked around the house, but after half an hour, the only things I found that might work were a deck of cards and some grapes. It was unclear to me how or why I'd be holding playing cards or a handful of grapes at a fistfight, so I put the idea on hold for now. All day Friday, the fight was all anyone talked about. Sean reiterated to me that if I didn't show up, he'd come to my house and beat the shit out of me himself. And I only lived 5 houses down from Sequoia Park, so this seemed like a real possibility. But his threats were unnecessary. As much as I really, truly did not want to go to this fight, I knew there was no way I'd let my new friends down. I was afraid in a way that was new to me, afraid of actual physical conflict. I imagined this is how it felt to be in a war. I felt like I was being fed into a machine. There was no way I could avoid it. I felt like I was going to die. I told my mom I was meeting some friends up at the park. "What about your pizzas?" she said. "You're going to miss Rockford." I wanted to cry. I would have given anything to just stay home and eat my snack and watch TV. But that wasn't an option. I told her I'd be back later. And then I walked out of the house and started up the hill toward Sequoia Park. My whole body felt weak with unfocused adrenaline. I kept feeling like stopping, then I'd force myself to keep going. I was so used to shrinking from anger and violence. I had been trained my whole life to just curl into a ball and take my beating and wait for it to be over. Maybe something will automatically happen. Some switch inside of me will get flicked on and I'll go crazy. I'll turn into a whirling dervish of violence like Bruce Lee or the Tasmanian Devil or Scott Svensson. Maybe it'll be like rushing. I'll magically be great and everyone will be impressed and I'll be in the middle of the feeling again. The feeling of being inside a group of guys doing something together that they can't do separately. Oh man, oh God, I prayed, I don't care about getting hurt. It's okay if you let me get hurt. Just don't let me embarrass myself. Please, God, don't let me chicken out. I crested the hill and Sequoia Park slowly came into view and I could not believe what I was seeing. A giant open expanse of grass between the playground and the baseball field, and it was swarming with absolutely no one. I'd never seen the park so empty. I was shocked. It was Friday, wasn't it? I checked my watch. It was 3:00. I was right on time. I looked around. No one was approaching. No one was there at all. I was the only one. And the conclusion I came to, the only one that made any sort of sense to me at the time, was this. Everyone else has chickened out. Out of all the boys at both schools, every single one of them has chickened out except for me. I didn't care that they'd chickened out. I was glad they had. Now I didn't have to fight anyone. But I had shown up. As scared as I was, I had shown up. I had faced my fear. I could feel my adrenaline ebbing and my heartbeat slowing to normal. I stood there looking around for another 5 minutes or so, just in case someone showed up. But no one did. So, I walked back down the hill to my house and made my pizzas and watched the Rockford Files and felt more relieved than I ever had in my life. Hey, you guys, I am thrilled to tell you that the International Association of Near-Death Studies is hosting their biggest conference ever in Bellevue, Washington, at the Bellevue Hyatt Regency this summer, August 26th to 30th, and you're invited. This event is open to the public. We can go. And the theme this year is Expanded Lives, Exploring the Impact of Near-Death and Related Experiences. You're going to meet regular people who have had NDEs, and you're going to be able to talk to them and find out exactly what happened to them. They're going to have guest speakers like Dr. Eben Alexander, author of the best-selling book Proof of Heaven, Betty Eady, author of the best-selling book Embraced by the Light, and Anita Murjani, author of Dying to Be Me. She has one of the most amazing near-death experience stories I've ever heard. There's even going to be a screening of a new movie, a documentary, about NDE researcher Kenneth Ring, who wrote the book The Omega Project. He's a total legend. Here's what you have to do. Go to IANDS.org. That's IANDS.org. Click through to events, register, and get an early bird discount. That's IANDS.org. Look, there's going to be an exhibit hall. There's going to be a bookstore. You heard me, a bookstore. There's even going to be parties. Have you ever partied with this crowd? It's unreal. Guys, they've had a near-death experience. They're next level. They've died and come back. They have no fear. I guarantee you cannot keep up with these guys. Go to IANDS.org. That's IANDS.org. And get your early bird tickets for the International Association of Near-Death Studies annual conference this August 26th through 30th in beautiful Bellevue, Washington. It's going to be like you died and went to heaven. See what I did there? On Monday, no one talked about the fight or the fact that there wasn't a fight because no one had shown up. I didn't talk about it either. I didn't want to embarrass Sean and the other guys by calling out the fact that they had chickened out. And I didn't brag that I was the only one who had shown up. I didn't have to. I felt brave and settled and centered within myself in a way I had never felt before. The other guys must have felt it too. Sean even stopped punching my arm. Or at least he did it less and with less enthusiasm than before. Sean and I became unbeatable. We were funny guys in homeroom and cool guys on the playground. Indubitably. Mr. Doty let us get away with murder in class because our humor was sophisticated. We prided ourselves on making Mr. Doty laugh first. Wildest of all, I even heard there were two different girls with sort of crushes on me. Sandy Trujillo and Paula Barnes. I knew it was my proximity to Sean that even put me on their radar, but that was fine with me. And I managed to kiss them both on different days after school and never felt like it had to go further. I was actually much more interested in hanging out with Sean and the other guys. It had taken 8 years, but I finally felt like I was an actual kid at Brightwood. Not an outsider, not above it all, and not invisible. For the first time in my life, I was acting my age. I was 13, and it felt fantastic. Now, like me, Stanley Milford had always wanted to be Carl Kolchak and face his fears head on. But as they say, be careful what you wish for. It was a normal night, just like any other, and isn't it always? Stanley had spent the day working at his job as a paranormal ranger. There was nothing new or unusual going on. He was single at the time and living alone. And as he climbed into bed and got ready to sleep, the only thing on his mind was the work he had to do tomorrow. Then, in the middle of the night, something happened. Quote, I came fully and instantly awake, It was like being thrown into the deep end of a very cold swimming pool. I blinked against a sudden harsh light. I tried to move my feet, legs, head, hands, fingers, but I couldn't. I was paralyzed. Was he dreaming? Stanley moved his eyes and looked around the room, taking careful note of every single detail that he recognized from the night before. Nope, he wasn't dreaming. He was completely awake. That's when he saw it. Quote, "A figure stood there in front of my closet next to my dresser. It was like the little green men I had read about and seen on TV, only it wasn't green. Its skin was a dull gray. It had the classic large, shiny, black, wet-looking eyes that are commonly described by those who have witnessed extraterrestrials. I thought its eyes looked more like goggles reflecting the blue lights about the room. I couldn't perceive any ears, nose, or mouth, but it did have a noticeably small protruding chin. Extending downward from bony shoulders, its arms were slender. Its neck and chest were very thin. The chest was maybe just under 12 inches at the widest part. The being stood approximately 4 feet tall." That's when Stanley noticed a horrible odor in the room, something he described as petroleum-like, combined with the smell of something dead or decaying. It was so bad he thought he was going to throw up. He describes the terror as being nearly unbearable. He thought he was going to die. And he was frozen, absolutely unable to defend or protect himself in any way. Then, at the instant the paralysis left him, the entity disappeared. Now I know what you're thinking. This is a classic case of sleep paralysis. That's what I thought. That's what he thought. He leapt out of bed and searched the room for any sign of the intruder. He even grabbed his handgun and held it in front of him as he looked inside his closet and under his bed. And as far as he could tell, there was no physical evidence that anyone or anything had been inside his home. In fact, it wasn't until he was about to get back into bed when he noticed it. There was something wrong with his shirt. It felt strange, like the collar was too high. He felt the tag of his pajamas against his throat. Quote, "I discovered my shirt was inside out and backward. Then I noticed my pajama bottoms were also inside out and backward." Stanley didn't know it at the time, but this was a common occurrence described in the literature of alien abduction. And this, of course, is where all talk of sleep paralysis falls apart. Stanley's mind turned on him, and he began to blame himself. Quote, "I kept asking myself if I had somehow caused this encounter to occur. I wondered if by investigating so many paranormal cases, I had inadvertently opened myself up to larger forces. There was also a lingering feeling of violation and trauma. The experience leaves you mentally, physically, and spiritually broken and violated. You stand there, shaking, embarrassed, alone, eyes wide, traumatized, trying to contemplate what has just happened, questioning why your higher power allowed this to happen to you." This is as close as Stanley ever comes to saying, "I wish to fuck I'd never become a paranormal ranger and just kept my head down and steered clear of all this bullshit." After all, it's one thing to be the person everyone turns to in a time of crisis. It's something else to be the person in crisis yourself. Stanley says he shares the story of his encounter now so that other people who have had a similar experience won't feel crazy, deluded, or misguided. Quote, "I think that hearing the testimony of the elderly Navajo man in Ganado in some ways prepared me for having my own experience with extraterrestrials. Because of his simple witness, I did not doubt myself or the experience. I hope that in some way my testimony here will provide a steadying hand to anyone who may need it." The Friday before spring break, Mr. Doty asked Sean and I to stay after school. I knew we weren't in trouble because A, I hadn't done anything wrong, and B, I had never done anything wrong. Since Sean and I were clearly class leaders and we were more or less co-teaching the homeroom with Mr. Doty, he was probably going to ask for our help with some class project or something. Once everyone was gone, we all sat down. Mr. Doty looked down at the table in front of him. This was odd. Mr. Doty always made eye contact. Finally, he spoke. "We need to talk and we need to get this settled," he said. "I don't like letting things fester. Your behavior over the last month has been outrageous. I've personally never seen anything like it. I don't know what's happened, but it can't go on because I know both of you want to graduate, and right now, I'm not sure that's going to happen." I was hearing Mr. Doty's words, but they weren't making any sense. What was this about not graduating? I felt like I was watching a tidal wave rising way offshore, building, growing, rolling, closer and closer, but not here yet. "To be honest," he said, "the only thing I can think of is that you're both on drugs. Because I am telling you, the personality changes, the behavior changes. I've never seen anything like it in my 22 years of teaching. Never." The tidal wave was almost on shore now. It was arcing above me, blocking out the sun. Drugs? He thought we were on drugs? Sure, Sean, I could see that. He was a bad kid. But me? Richie Cunningham? I was the most straight-laced kid in the entire school. Accusing me of taking drugs was like accusing Ozzy Osbourne of not taking drugs. It was insane. He finally looked up at us and said, "Well, is there anything you'd like to say?" Sean leaned back in his chair and crossed his arms and lowered his eyelids in that reptilian way he had and quietly said, "No." Mr. Doty turned his gaze on me, and I sang like a canary. "I am not on drugs, Mr. Doty. I've never done drugs. I've never done anything." My voice was cracking. I was terrified. I was on the verge of crying. I couldn't help it. What Jim Rockford would do right now was irrelevant. Mr. Doty said, "I want you to know I've already called both your parents and expressed my concerns." And this is when the tidal wave hit. "You told my parents I'm on drugs," I said. "Yes, Richard, I did." This was officially the worst moment of my life. Forget the fact that it was absolutely not true. Forget the fact that this entire conversation was insane. If a teacher had already called my house and told my parents he thought I was on drugs, then my life was over. No matter what I said to them, there would be no coming back from this. Ever. My parents had both been school teachers and had made it very clear. A bad grade here or there was one thing, but a teacher calling them about bad behavior in class was unthinkable. It was the one thing that could never happen. And now it had happened in a way that was a million times worse than I could ever have imagined. "It's because of Sean," I thought. "It's because I'm friends with Sean. Sean's a bad kid, so Mr. Doty thinks I am too. Great. Fucking great." I looked over at Sean, but he wouldn't meet my gaze. He just kept staring into the distance. Why isn't he denying this? Why isn't he helping me? The next thing I thought was, I need to get out of this room, and I need to call my mom, and I need to tell her I'm not on drugs. As soon as Mr. Doty let us go, I grabbed my stuff and ran down to the phone booth by the front offices. I pulled a dime out of my pocket. My hands were shaking. My whole body was shaking. I managed to jam the dime into the slot and dial. My mom picked right up. "Mom," I said, "I'm not on drugs." She said, "I know. I don't know why he called you, but I swear to you, I'm not on drugs." "I know," she said. "We'll talk about it when you get home." I felt a little better, but as I walked home, any relief I felt quickly evaporated. My mom had sounded calm, but was she just waiting to get me alone in the house before she really tore into me? That would be much more her style. By the time I got home, I was more scared than I'd been in Mr. Doty's room. But when I opened the front door, There was no wave of bad feelings washing over me, the way it usually did when my mom was in one of her moods. The television was on. She was watching Phil Donahue. Everything seemed normal. I went over and sat on the couch and looked at the floor and basically waited for whatever was to come. "I'm sorry, Mom, but I didn't do anything, I swear," I said. "So what happened?" she said. I told her everything Mr. Doty had said and everything I had said back. When I was done, my mom said, "He doesn't like you. You're acting up in class and taking attention away from him, and he doesn't like it." But there was something odd in her tone. There was no rage. She was somehow grounded and plain-spoken. Then she said, "He feels threatened by you." Now, this made no sense to me. He was a teacher. I was just a kid. How could he feel threatened by me? But my mom said it in that way that grown-ups did when they were stating a fact about life they couldn't explain and had no intention of even trying. "So what am I supposed to do?" I said. "Just go to school," she said. "Sit there, do the work, and come home. You only have 2 more months. Just get through." She seemed resigned, but also a little angry, only not at me. She's angry at Mr. Doty, I thought. She doesn't respect him as a teacher. She doesn't like the way he does his job. My mom was on my side. She knew me better than he did, and she thought I was doing just fine. I couldn't believe it. I wasn't in trouble. Just like the non-existent fight with the guys from Highlands, I had been terrified beyond all reason in one moment, just to find myself completely out of danger and flooded with relief in the next. I had thought that being scared and surviving would make me braver, like Carl Kolchak or Jim Rockford. But that's not how it was playing out. I wasn't getting good at being scared. I was just getting jumpy and punch drunk, and I didn't like it. 2 days before Easter, the doorbell rang. It was Sean Delgado. I could see him at our front gate through the window by the door. It was weird. Sean had never come to my house. I went outside and met him on the front yard. Sean didn't say hello. He said, "What did you say to him?" "Who?" I said. Sean said, "When Mr. Doty called your house yesterday, what did you say?" "He didn't call my house," I said. Sean looked at me, trying to see if I was lying. But as I looked at him, I saw something on his face I'd never seen before. Worry. Maybe even fear. It became clear to both of us at the exact same moment. Mr. Doty had followed up with Sean's parents, but not with mine. Was Sean getting in trouble? What would that even look like? It was something I'd never even considered. I suddenly felt guilty for some reason. "If he calls," Sean said, "tell him I don't do anything. Nothing. I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't do anything, okay?" "Yeah, of course, man, I won't say anything." Sean was staring at the ground now. He didn't look scared anymore. He just looked sad. Then he nodded his head and said thanks and turned around and left. I almost wished him a happy Easter, but luckily I stopped myself before doing something so stupid.
A lot of you have reached out asking for help with your personal creative projects. Maybe you're writing a TV pilot or a movie. Maybe you're trying your hand at memoir. You want to tell the story of your life, kind of like this podcast. Maybe it's a novel or a short story or a graphic novel. Whatever it is, go to richardhaddam.com and click on Richard Haddam's Writer's Room. I can read what you've got so far, help you bring it to the finish line. Or I can read a finished script or a story and help you get it into professional shape so you can finally send it out into the world. Go to richardhaddam.com, click on Richard Haddam's Writer's Room, and let's get to work. Mention that you heard about it on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf, and you'll instantly get a 20% discount, okay? Working with me isn't free. It's not even cheap, but it's worth it. Don't wait any longer. Now's the time to make your dreams come true. Get unstuck at Richard Haddam's Writer's Room at richardhaddam.com.
By the time Stanley Milford investigated what he called the Window Rock Haunting, he was a complete and total paranormal ranger. Also a complete and total badass. It's like he was born to investigate this haunted office building. And guys, let me tell you, the Window Rock office building is haunted as shit. A two-story sandstone structure in downtown Window Rock, Arizona from the 1930s that over the years has been everything from a theater to a library to a morgue. And it was now a government office. The director of the office space said that almost everyone in her department had experienced something paranormal, and it was getting to the point where it was, quote, difficult for people to get their work done. I love how that's her big complaint. Anyway, all the employees in the building had experienced something. They'd heard disembodied voices, felt invisible hands, or seen objects move around the various rooms. One woman had even received dozens of untraceable phone calls where she heard vague whispering sounds. Stanley put together a team, which is so badass to say out loud. The team consisted of LaVon Benelli, one of the office workers who would be able to give them access to the entire building, Stanley's nephew, Tony Milford Jr., a, quote, audiovisual wizard, and a ghost hunter named Dusty Delgado, who wins the prize for coolest name of any human being who's ever lived. This is a guy Stanley and John met by chance at a Lotta Burger in New Mexico, which wins the prize for coolest way ever to meet a ghost hunter. Dusty introduced himself when he heard John and Stanley talking about Bigfoot. They became instant friends, so Stanley figured, why not bring him along? Stanley arrives at the office building long after the close of business. It's full dark. He meets LaVon, who takes him on a tour of the building. Here's what happens in the first 2 hours. LaVon takes him through the ground floor where all the employees work, and then leads him down into the basement, which is currently being used as a storage area. LaVon heads back upstairs to unlock some other rooms. Stanley voluntarily stays behind, getting used to the normal background noise of the building. Quote, suddenly, I felt an invisible finger touch my upper lip. The finger moved slowly across my mustache from one side to the other and then back again. Okay, here's the thing. If I felt an actual living human being slowly run their finger across my upper lip, I'd lose my shit. Stanley goes on, quote, before I could move or respond, I heard two distinct male voices about 3 feet to my left. There was no one there, but I could hear them and determined they were Navajo based on their accents. I couldn't make out what they were saying, but it was a clear back and forth conversation that lasted approximately 10 seconds. I didn't feel afraid, only excited. I felt like an explorer with the complete unknown ahead of me. Dusty and Tony show up and spend about half an hour unloading all their electrical equipment, setting everything up in the basement storage area, since, you know, it's as haunted as fuck. Stanley gathers the troops and briefs them on what's already happened. And just as he finishes talking, he feels something hit him on the shoulder. He looks down to see a quarter on the floor, laying heads up. Weird. They start exploring the rest of the basement, and it happens again. Another quarter hitting the ground, spinning, and landing heads up. At this point, Stanley tells everyone to stop, empty their pockets, and pull them out like rabbit ears. No one is carrying loose change. As an experiment, Stanley has them all head into the women's bathroom on the main floor and turn out the lights. From the book, quote, as we waited in the darkness, the sound of coins hitting the floor began. One of us quickly turned the lights back on just in time to see more coins raining down. There were 8 in total, quarters, dimes, nickels, and pennies. They were all heads up. Now, Stanley never says why he suggested the women's bathroom for this experiment, but my theory is if someone had arranged for an accomplice to fake supernatural effects, it would most likely be a man, and the least likely place they'd be hiding was the women's restroom. I mean, come on, some taboos really are impossible to overcome. The coin thing kept happening all weekend, all over the building. 65 coins fell in a 48-hour period. Stanley even saw one fly from just beneath the ceiling all the way across the room and onto the floor, a distance of 30 feet. And of course, just like the other 64 coins, it landed heads up. Side note, I had my son Dashiell do an experiment. He took 65 coins of various denominations and dropped them onto the ground from shoulder height. His results? 37 heads, 28 tails. Three more trials produced the same basic results. In no case did heads or tails represent more than 39 of the 65 coins. Stanley and the others took digital pictures of every room to establish whether anything was later moved. In one wide-angle shot that encompassed the entire bullpen, Stanley discovered hundreds of orbs hovering above the cubicles. He used photo software to enlarge the shot and zoomed in on the orbs themselves. From the book, quote, "All of the orbs had human faces. I don't mean that they had something your brain could pattern into a face, as with pareidolia, or visual matrixing, which causes us to make meaningful patterns in everything we see. I mean, they had human faces. Real, distinct human faces. Each one with individual features as different from one another as if they were living people in a room. Office chairs rolled across the floor on their own accord. A large computer battery slammed into a wall near Stanley's head. A Navajo wedding vase exploded in an unoccupied room, all within the first 2 hours. And then things got weird. Stanley rigged a battery-operated microphone on a large rod that Tony carried from room to room. The hope was to record some EVPs. Now that didn't happen. Instead, what they got were out loud, paranormal voices that they could hear in the room right beside them, answering their questions. From the book, quote, "Is anybody there?" "Yes, I am here," a man's voice said. He spoke English, but to me when I listened to the recording later, the voice sounded Navajo in tone and inflection. "Can you give me your name?" Tony asked. The spirit gave his name. The spirit was giving active, intelligent, and deliberate responses to all of Tony's questions. It wasn't like a tape being played back, as in some residual hauntings. This was a conscious being choosing to interact with Tony. How could a spirit process a communicated question? Living humans have a brain to perform this function, but how could a spirit do the same? Yes, the spirit was once a living person, but now as a ghost, it does not have a body with a head and a cranium that houses a brain, or a mouth or vocal cords to create speech and words. So how was it possible? I didn't know, but it was happening. After their weekend investigation concluded, another well-known aspect of the poltergeist phenomenon presented itself. The haunting followed Stanley back to his home. Objects flew around, heavy footsteps pounded across the ceiling, and coins continued to fall, all of them landing heads up. When he called his nephew Tony to report this news, he got a shock. The same thing was happening at Tony's house, only worse. There, the activity seemed aggressive and malevolent. A 12-inch butcher knife flew across the kitchen in full view of both Stanley and his nephew and lodged in a grapefruit by the sink. Tony was so shaken by the activity that he eventually consulted with a pastor who came to the house and recited prayers, and then just to be safe, he instructed Tony to gather everything the poltergeist had touched and burn it. Stanley decided against this approach. The paranormal activity at his house didn't scare him, and in fact, it gave him a way to study the phenomena up close. Keep your friends close and your ghosts closer, I guess. Either way, after the Window Rock haunting, everything changed for Stanley Milford. The world of the supernatural wasn't a maybe thing anymore. It was real, undeniable. And more, Stanley knew it was the world that he wanted to be in and explore. For me, everything changed after spring break. Or maybe I should say, everything changed back. After 6 months of actually being a kid among kids for the first time in my life, I drifted back to the old ways, on the outside looking in. Looking at Mr. Doty and realizing for the first time in my life how an adult could so completely disappoint and betray a child. Looking at Sean Delgado and seeing a dark halo around him that stretched from wherever he was all the way back to his home, an indistinct shadow that made him what he was. When I stood outside of things, I could see them better and clearly understand them. They seemed smaller, and for a while, I'd feel safer. But soon enough, the fear would creep back in, because on the outside, I was alone, and alone is never better. Sean and I didn't talk much anymore, and the bruise on my left arm started to heal, and one day, it just wasn't there anymore. Because of Mr. Doty's accusations, the friendship soured. Was it embarrassment? Distrust? I never knew. I just knew it was over, and it hurt more than getting punched ever did. Sean and the other sports guys started a dodgeball game that consumed every recess and even drifted into PE, but I wasn't a part of it. My days reverted to spending lunch and recess on my own, or maybe hanging out with Gary Takeuchi, but even he seemed to have moved on. I could feel the end coming, the end of my days at Brightwood. One afternoon, I slipped into the boys' room during PE. This had become a habit. I could usually kill 10 minutes before anyone noticed I was gone. It was my quiet time. I was just about to head back out when the door slammed open, and from inside the stall, I heard someone scream in rage. Whoever it was started punching the paper towel dispenser, and each time they hit it, they let out a harsh, choked barking sound. I stepped out of the stall. It was Scott Svensson, and he was basically having some kind of psychotic attack. I tried to sneak out, but he turned and saw me and screamed, "What the fuck, man?" Blood was pouring from his nose. His eyes were red, and it took me a minute to process that he was crying, and the barking sounds I had heard were his sobs. "What the fuck?" He turned away from me and went back to punching the paper towel dispenser until the knuckles on his right hand started to bleed. I could easily have walked out at that point, but then I thought, what would Jim Rockford do? For some reason, I wasn't scared. Once I realized he was crying, whatever fear I had left. "What happened?" I said. He spun and looked at me, panting. "They wouldn't fucking leave me alone. I never did anything to them." It took a while, but I finally got that today's dodgeball game had basically devolved into an all-school attack on Scott. Something happened, and suddenly the two opposing teams became one, and Scott was the sole target. Everyone was launching balls at him, screaming and laughing. A year's worth of fear and anger unleashed on one person in one afternoon. At some point, Scott lost his footing and fell on the ground, and that's when Sean and the other sports guys moved in for the kill. I never knew if they actually started beating him with their bare hands, but either way, it was over for Scott. For a year, he had kept everyone at bay with his crazy, out-of-control behavior, and today was the day they took him down. He stood there crying in front of me. Then he pounded his fists on the sink until it loosened from the wall. But by then, he was too tired to move anymore. "Fuck those guys, Scott." This is not the way I normally spoke. I don't think I'd ever used the F word out loud before. But something about seeing him crying got to me. "Fuck 'em. They're not your friends. They never were. They're nobody. Just ignore them. He was gasping now. How am I supposed to do that? I said, the school isn't your whole life. This is just a few hours a day. In a couple of months, he won't even be here anymore. He was starting to calm down. None of this matters, I said. I know it seems like it does, but it doesn't. It's just eighth grade. Scott didn't say anything. Then the bell rang. When I walked out, he was staring at himself in the square of brushed metal that served as a mirror. Fear creates confusion. It destabilizes. Just when you need clear eyes and perspective the most, it is lost. It's hard to fight a fire from inside the burning house. And you can't catch yourself when you're the one falling off the roof. Balance is what you need, or maybe just one stable thing to hold on to. For years, Stanley Milford was the person the residents of the Navajo Nation went to when their problems seemed to emerge from the darkest place they could imagine. Capable, self-reliant people found themselves turning to Stanley when their fears robbed them of forward movement. And for years, Stanley Milford helped them. He stood just far enough inside their world to understand it, but also far enough outside of it to see it clearly and help people face their fears head on. He lived for years in tenuous balance, with one foot in physical reality and the other in paranormal possibility. But ultimately, he found true stability when he stepped away from his third world, the world of police work. As he grew older, he found himself more and more at odds with his tasks as a law enforcement officer. From the book, quote, I was becoming disillusioned with law enforcement. Seeing so much evidence of police brutality and corruption disgusted and embarrassed me, and I was now certain that law enforcement was a profession that no longer represented what I stood for. At about the same time, the questions that emerged from his work as a paranormal ranger began to exert a greater pull on him than ever. So this became the path that he followed, bringing the knowledge he gained in the Navajo Nation all over the world, where people were experiencing things they couldn't explain. Quote, the inevitable outcome of learning more about the paranormal is that it expands your view of the world and the universe, of humankind, and even of yourself. My career as a paranormal investigator, in many ways, is only just beginning, and I'm excited about all the things I don't know yet, the stories I haven't heard, and the people I haven't yet helped. For the rest of the day after my encounter with Scott Svensson in the boys' room, I felt scared and oddly anxious. Everything I'd said to Scott was true, but it applied to me as much as to him. Was I really as alone as he was? It wasn't a real question, since I already knew the answer. Apart from the past few months, I had always been alone. The only difference between me and Scott was that I knew how to be alone. It was something I had learned from Carl Kolschak and Jim Rockford, and I was good at it. For the last 2 months of school, my body showed up at Brightwood, but my mind was elsewhere. All I cared about was going home, cooking my little pizzas, sitting in my rocking chair, and watching the Rockford Files. At that point, my journal contained over 90 episodes. But now it contained something else, something totally new. On the back pages, I had started making notes about a story I was going to write about how Jim Rockford and his friend Angel Martin met as cellmates and did some kind of con job together in prison. I never ended up writing it, but that was okay, because I discovered that the simple act of thinking about writing made me feel good. And for my final days in Mr. Doty's class and Brightwood School, that's all I did. I looked out the window and thought about writing. Thinking about writing became an essential preparatory step to actually writing. But that was years later. In June of 1980, I graduated eighth grade, and all of the people who crowded my days that year and my whole career at Brightwood, well, most of them, including Sean Delgado, I never saw again. Meanwhile, I had learned to live my life with a foot in two worlds. The real world, and the one I had created inside my imagination. Because I figured, if I was never completely inside my real life, I could never really be hurt. If a part of me, the real, true part of me, was in a world of my own creation, I would always, always be safe. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producers are Tess Feifel, Sailor Franklin, and Harrison Marks. Our sound designer, editor, and engineer is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, our website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Please join us next time as we explore the world of children who remember past lives with Jim B. Tucker's Return to Life. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.